Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 114. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today, I'm talking with Salvatore D'Agostino, who many of you will already know as the host of Your Right to Speak, which airs right here on CYC Podcast on the second Wednesday of every month. Salvatore has just finished writing his master's thesis, and he graciously sent it to me, which I really enjoyed reading. And in the reading, it raised all sorts of pertinent issues, which he and I both agreed would be great conversation for us to share on the podcast today. And so that's exactly what we're going to do. Thank you for joining me today, Salvatore.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited about this conversation, and congratulations. That's really, it's a great piece of work, and it's been a long process, I expect, for you.
It has been. It challenged me in ways that I didn't expect, but good challenges.
Nice. If we can look back at challenges and say they're good challenges, then things are okay.
Right.
So you did a critical discourse analysis of something called, in Ontario, we call it the Identification, Placement, and Review Committee, or IPRC, the policy. And a lot of your work in that document looks at the relationship between adults and children through a policy lens. And you write about something called adultism. Now, you've talked about adultism before on your podcast. But for those of you, for those of us, for those listeners who are not familiar with the term, could you just explain a little bit about what adultism is?
Yes, definitely. And I'm happy you had brought that up because it really isn't a well-researched, I guess we can call it, concept. So I'm more than happy to explain it.
Nice.
Adultism is really, it can be defined as the behaviors and attitudes that adults have based on assumptions that they know better than the young person. So it's really adults having power over young people and not allowing them to express their views and opinions because of the age of the young person. So it really goes into the idea that young people are inferior to adults.
So, this idea that young people are inferior, I want to explore this a little bit. Are there not situations that require people to make choices for other people, so for adults to make choices for young people?
Yes, and adultism is saying that It's not that it's not recognizing that young people do need guidance in life. What it's saying is it becomes adultism when young people start to foster self-worthlessness, low self-esteem, those negative aspects. Mm. Adultism also, and I think it's really important to talk about this distinction, which I'm still trying to wrap my head around, it considers that all young people have the capability to express their opinions. We as adults just have to allow for that capacity. Now, maybe vice versa. I can't remember exactly. I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around it. But it's really saying that all young people can participate. We as adults just have to meet the young person where they're at and guide them along the way.
Right. So there's a recognition that young people have different capacities, and we can't assume that a four-year-old necessarily is going to have the language to be able to read the IPRC policy document. And so that as they age, and you know, by 6 years old when they're in grade one, it's unrealistic to give them the policy and say, okay, read this and then give me your feedback. Yet there are ways that we can include them into the discussions about the policy. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yes and no.
Okay.
And this is where I had to really challenge myself in my research study. My supervisor that I was working with had brought up a great point that when we talk about child rights, we often say that we have to use child-friendly language or meet the young person's capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's adultism in itself. That's already lowering a young person's capability to participate in decisions that affect their lives. So it's really, and it's a little bit of a radical way of thinking, but we really as adults have to kind of take away that child-friendly language. Hmm. And at an early age, communicate to children the same way we communicate with adults, instead of having two different forms of communication.
And do we risk in that ignoring the differences between adults and children?
Well, what are the full differences between adults and children?
The full?
We have to recognize that young people are the experts in their own lives, right? And yes, they do need guidance. Adults do come. We live in a world that is structured for adults. It's really not structured for young people to realistically participate, at least in Western society. So I lost my train of thought, but we need to really start broadening our understanding and changing our way of thinking that children are not capable or do not understand certain forms of language or communication. Now, it is a bit in the gray zone. This is not going to be clear cut because there are different disabilities that come with different capabilities. So that also has to be recognized, but it's really, you know, starting at a younger age and taking away that less, I call it less a form of communication, right? So the most shocking example that I can give, and I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but, you know, when we talk about sex with children, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about the different body parts, right? If we're calling, you know, a penis a pee-pee,
mm-hmm.
right? The young person's going to grow up thinking that it's called a pee-pee until later on in life. But if we start at an early age calling it a penis, that's that normal communication or that adult communication, right?
Yeah, I think
it's
that's
not...
Sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. Go on. I lost my train of thought.
I think that's a great example, and it makes it really concrete for me, the difference between this, you know, almost patronizing language or diminishing language. And I think that a refusal to use effective language, and then we see it carry on through life, and those people who are not comfortable saying penis and vagina and vulva and anus are the same ones, I suspect, often who were exposed to other language as children, right? And so somehow, you know, there is a discomfort in that language which carries us throughout our life, and then how as adolescents and young adults and older adults and seniors even, how do we then have conversations about pleasure, for example, if it's about my pee-pee as opposed to this is what I like to do with my penis or my vulva or my vagina or anus or whatever it might
right.
be. I think that's a really nice, nice example. So you, continuing with this idea of language, you used a technique called critical discourse analysis, and this isn't a show about research, although sometimes I think we're a little bit frightened of research in child and youth care, and sometimes we think, you know, research is a bad thing, all evidence-based practices need to be critically critiqued, and there's nothing for us in research. And I'm of the opinion that research has a tremendous amount to offer us. And critical discourse analysis is a particular type of research, particular approach, which I've long been intrigued by. Could you explain to us, relatively briefly, if that's possible, what critical discourse analysis is?
So really, very generally and broadly speaking, it's looking at the means behind the language used.
Looking at the means behind the language used. What do you mean by that?
Sorry, the meaning.
Oh, so, the meanings. Okay.
Yeah. So a classic way to do discourse analysis, and it's very similar to content analysis, but a discourse analysis may look at all, let's say, the newspaper clippings in the last several years related, let's say, to car theft, just to throw an example, right? So a discourse analysis will then look at the taglines and say, does it say black youth stole car? Does it say youth stole car? Does it say adult stole car? And if black youth keeps on coming up, why are we putting black youth with car theft? Hmm. And it's really looking, and it's really at the core of it, it's looking at the power imbalances between different communities, I would say.
And how does identifying language help us to understand the power imbalances that exist? And maybe you can use your own discourse analysis of the IPRC document.
So, one of the major findings that I found in my research was that the language used in the IPRC specifically does not allow students with disabilities younger than the age of 16 to participate.
Mm.
So I look at that and I say, well, what are they really, what is the meaning behind statements like that? Are they saying that young people, age 16 and older, automatically have the competency to participate in decisions that affect their lives? I would say yes. If we bring in the disability element, are we saying that young people with disabilities, once they hit 16, they're automatically able to participate? So it's really looking at statements like that and saying, what are they really trying to get here? What's the meaning behind those words? Discourse analysis also takes a very specific theoretical orientation or lens. So when I did mine, I chose the child rights perspective.
So looking at the language in the IPRC document from a specific lens, a child rights lens, to say, okay, this is how I'm going to see it, and these are the words that I'm going to look for in particular, or the language I'm going to look for in particular.
Exactly. So I look specifically through the child rights lens, and I use the UNCRC as my grounding,
mm-hmm.
right? But if someone could also do a discourse analysis on the same policy and look at it through a critical disability lens,
mm-hmm.
Which gives it a different type of focus.
Right. Nice. So you said that you identified this sort of magic number around 16, which seems to be regardless of the individual. So it's not... it's not based upon individual capacity as much as this sort of chronological capacity. Is that correct? That's one of the findings?
Yeah.
Why is that? You hinted at that. Why is it an issue to have some sort of age, you know, framework to say, hey, look, people at this age, you know, are more able to be involved. People younger than this are less able to be involved. Why is that a concern for you from a child rights perspective?
Because really, you know, at the core of the UNCRC, the right to participation, it does say that all children, no matter what age, have the capability to participate in decisions that affect their lives.
Right.
So when we put an age on that, like within the IPRC, it's already automatically, in my opinion, not fulfilling the right to participation.
Right. So let's talk about participation as an approach, and we can talk about the IPRC, and I'd like to broaden it as well to working with young people in general. your last podcast with Nancy and Fallon, which I thought there were some really lovely examples, but Nancy brought in some really lovely examples of how to involve people who identify as autistic into the discussion about how they want to work with care providers. So images and comfort and body language and things like that. How do we, in a concrete way, how do we include 4, 6, 8, 12-year-olds into discussions around policy and consent and action regarding the issues that affect their lives?
So I think it's two, and I kind of mentioned that in my thesis. The first piece is we have to start right away with, I call it the next generation of young people, starting to communicate with them without using child-friendly language. Taking that away automatically. With the current, you know, generation of young people, yes, we need to start communicating with them in adult form of communication, or normal form of communication. But there is a little bit of a lag there because child-friendly language has already been used with them. So at that point, then it's developing structures and mechanisms to kind of allow for young people then to be able to participate in these discussions, if I'm making sense.
So what does that look like when, I was talking to a teacher yesterday who is working in a classroom of grade 3 students, and she's really struggling. She's having a very, very difficult time with the class, and she's used to working with older youth, high school aged people, and she's having a really difficult time communicating with them effectively, and is finding herself resorting to yelling because, from her perception, it's the only thing that's effective, the only thing that works. In those cases, you know, when she tries to give autonomy and say, "Okay, sit where you want," all the boys pile on each other and start poking and punching each other, and so then she becomes very controlling. This is beyond just language, but it seems to me that at the core there's about communication and behaviors and language and how do we communicate. So as an educator working in the school system with children who are in grade 3, so around 8-9 years old, how do we bring in that sort of non-child-friendly language in a way that's going to be received by young people?
Well, that's a whole other episode on a podcast. I mean, my answer, you may sound like a cop-out of it, but we need to restructure our whole education system.
Right.
In my opinion. And it's the way it's structured now, it's very authoritative, right? Mm-hmm. So children are growing up in that environment. Once they're given that little bit of leeway, yeah, they're going to take advantage of it because they're not used to it. Right? So we need to really restructure the whole thing. So again, as at an early age, they're growing up in an environment, they're practicing participation and have that autonomy. So when it's given to them, it's not going to be this kind of new cool thing and let me see where I can go with it.
Right. You've been really open on your own podcast, you're right, to speak, and in your thesis you talk a lot about your own disability, learned disabilities, experiences with disabilities. How has your own disability shaped you as a child and youth care practitioner?
Very good question. My disability has really, I still struggle with it, to be honest, and still struggle with identifying with it. However, that helps me work with young people. I truly understand what it's like if you want to hide your disability. Mm-hmm. I get it. I get the stigma behind that. I get it sometimes when, you know, you're scared to apply to a job because you're not too sure. So in terms of working with young people with disabilities, it shaped me greatly because it's giving me this huge understanding of what it's like. In terms of working with broader young people in various communities, I mean, I am a white male, mm-hmm. but I'm also part of a marginalized community. Mm-hmm. And I, because I'm a white male, I don't face all the challenges and stigmas, but as well, because I am part of that disability community, I do understand what it's like to have your voice taken away from you and what some of those challenges are. And I really use those experiences to connect with young people because I get it. I mean, I'm real with young people. I don't want to swear on here, but I don't, you know, lie to them and pretend. I'm very real with them. And I get the struggles because I've had those same struggles.
There's a lot of discussion in particularly disability and radical disability studies and things like MAD studies about this, some people call it a strategic essentialism, right? That I'm going to use my disability to make change, and I'm going to claim my disability, and as a group, we're going to claim our common disability to make change. You've written about your own challenges in the school system as somebody with learning disabilities. Do you think that it requires people with a particular lived experience in order to make changes regarding that lived experience, or it requires people with disabilities to learn disabilities to critique the IPRC to change the IPRC?
I mean, I think someone with lived experience is going to understand the challenges and the gaps within the education system because they've lived through it. With that being said, though, I mean, there's allies who do not have a disability at all and are very passionate about working within the community. They get aspects of those challenges as well. So for me, it's, you don't necessarily have to have a disability to change, because I think that puts a lot of pressure on, I mean, people living with disabilities. They may not want to see themselves as activists or advocates. So I think you need allies and you need people with lived experience. But I don't think it should be one or the other. I think the problem with using someone who has lived experience, you've become tokenized. Mm. And that was very, you know, when I was at the advocate's office, often talking about my experience, I really tried to set those boundaries because I didn't want to be tokenized. Mm-hmm. And I don't speak for everyone who has a learning disability. I don't represent the whole of the community. I represent a small part of the community, but most importantly, I represent myself.
Right. Nice. Right? Said.
So for me, and don't get me wrong, sometimes we need tokenism to make change. But it's a balance that needs to be done.
Right. Your academic career took it was a fascinating and intriguing shift. So your undergrad was in child and youth care, and then your master's was in policy and policy studies. Why is it relevant for child and youth care practitioners to think about and critique and be familiar with policy?
So happy you asked that. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, policies and programming really are what COICs mostly fall back on, right? Mm. We have to follow legislation. We have to follow the program guidelines. And if we don't understand those, I believe we won't be fully effective in our work. At the same time, if we're not critiquing it, how's the system ever going to change? I mean, I'm not probably the only COIC who is taking a master's in public policy, but we're a rare breed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, I mean, I can probably count on my hand how many COICs are actually in the public service. I haven't come across a whole bunch of them. So we come with a particular understanding and training, just like social workers do.
Indeed. Well, I know that you're, there may be changes in your life coming up, but I'm currently in BC, and it's quite amazing actually how many CYCs or graduates of CYC programs are actually working in a policy level in the Ministry of Child and Family Development out here in British Columbia. I've been quite struck by that actually, and I've
I mean, in all honesty, I've looked at job postings, and they actually have part of the qualifications is a CYC diploma or master's, as well as other, you know, types of professions. But here in Ontario, for you to get into the Ministry of Community and Social Services or MCYS, Child and Youth Services, I have never seen a posting to include child and youth care. I've always seen MSW.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some significant differences between the Ontario and BC, which are fascinating, and maybe you can do a critical discourse analysis of job postings in those two different provinces for ministry positions someday. And I think that would be
sooner than later, maybe.
Yeah, it could be your PhD, perhaps.
Yeah.
As we move towards wrapping this up, Salvatore, is there any other questions that you wish I would ask you before we end?
No, but there is something that I kind of just would like to say that I
Please.
Feel like I haven't gotten a chance to yet. When we often talk about, you know, young people not participating and, you know, we bring in the adultism lens, that when I talk here in Western society. Mm. I had recently had a conversation with Richard Mitchell, who's a researcher and a professor at Brock University, and his area is in child rights. And, you know, he was telling me that in the UK and I think Scotland, he was saying there are young people that are participating in policy development.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's other parts in this world that have considered adultism. I just think that Canada on a lot of services is kind of lagging behind in that. So we need to push to kind of, in my opinion, catch up with the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And the very notion of childhood and adolescence is, you know, again, looking at discourse analysis, comes from a very particular socioeconomic conditions that have created these designations of childhood, youth, adolescence, emerging adult, senior, all these chronological structures mm-hmm. that exist, which do not exist in every culture in the same way. So I think that's an excellent point. Salvatore, I want to thank you so much for sending me your thesis. I find it very valuable, and we only touched on just a few elements of it, and there's a lot more in there, and I hope that you can perhaps publish it or publish elements of it elsewhere, because I think that it has a lot to offer child and youth care and the public at large.
Thank you.
Thanks for having this conversation, and thanks for all your amazing work on disability and disability studies and your conversations you've had at your right to speak. For those of you who are interested in learning more, there's a real significant body of conversations over there at your right to speak. Thanks for talking today.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.